reducing child poverty in Maine. The latest Kids Count data report estimates that the number of children living below the poverty line in Maine in 2017 was about 14%, which is better than in past years, but still one of the worst in New England. About half of those live in what's called deep poverty, in which their family income is less than $10,000 a year. There are a number of societal implications from this. Children who grow up in poverty are less likely to be employed as adults and are more likely to have serious health problems later in life. I'm Jennifer Rooks. A number of advocacy groups in Maine have come together to tackle childhood poverty in Maine. Groups as varied as the Maine Chamber of Commerce and Maine Equal Justice are working together in the group called Invest in Tomorrow. We'll learn about their efforts next on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maine has one of the highest rates of childhood poverty in New England. What does that mean for the future, and what's being done to change that? Joining me in the studio, Claire Berkowitz, who is Executive Director of the Maine Children's Alliance, and Robin Merrill, Executive Director of Maine Equal Justice. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have personal experience in breaking the cycle of poverty? Do you have ideas for the state, for the nonprofits in our state? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Claire and Robin, welcome back to Maine Calling. I appreciate you being here for this such an important issue. And Claire, why don't I start with you by asking, what do we know about the rate of childhood poverty in Maine? I've seen a lot of varied statistics this morning. Has the economy, the improving economy nationwide, helped this measure?
Yes. Well, thanks so much for having us here today to talk about this important issue, because at the Maine Children's Alliance, we definitely believe that children are maybe 20% of our state, but 100% of our future. And so we need all of our children to thrive and reach their full potential. And one area where we really need to keep tabs on is child poverty. And right now we have about 35,000 children in Maine living in poverty. That's a family of four, maybe making around $25,000 or less a year. So that's 14%, 14.2% of our kids in poverty. You might see other numbers from, they're all U.S. Census Bureau statistics, but depending on the measure you're looking at, there might be some variability. But we, as a Kids Count grantee of the state, we use the 14.2 so that we can do some comparisons to across geographies, looking at county level statistics.
And I learned a new phrase, the phrase deep poverty. This is families less than $10,000 a year, and there are a lot of kids in Maine living at this level.
That's right. There are about a little over 14,000 children living in deep poverty. That's 50% of the poverty threshold that we were just talking about. And so those are kids who are living, you know, with very scarce resources, and it's impactful to them on so many levels. It's an adverse childhood experience to grow up in poverty, persistent poverty. It can hurt brain development in young children, cognitive, social, emotional, and health development. So it's important to work with families who have young children growing up in poverty, making sure that they're getting their needs met so that they can reach their full potential.
And am I right in that even though the number of children in poverty over the last decade has been going down gradually in Maine, the number of children in deep poverty has been going up?
It's remained about, you know, steady, where the kids whose parents might have been working low income, what we're seeing is minimum wage jobs. With the increase in the minimum wage, we're seeing some improvement for those families. So those are people at the lower end of the economic strata, but we're seeing some improvement in those families, and so that's wonderful. But there are these families who maybe don't have that access to a full-time regular job that didn't benefit from that increase, and so those kids, their parents face barriers to employment that that are keeping them from benefiting from the economy that has helped so many others during this time.
Robin Merrill, I know that you are a big part of this new initiative called Invest in Tomorrow. Tell me about that. Who has come together and what are your goals?
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to come on and speak about this important issue with you all today. So Maine Equal Justice, we're a civil legal aid provider, and we really focus on increasing economic security and opportunity in our state. And over a year ago, a number of organizations and individuals came together, recognizing that we really all have an interest in addressing and reducing child poverty here in Maine. So originally, we came together with the Maine Children's Alliance, with the State Chamber of Commerce, with Maine Community Foundation, with Maine Community Action Association, lots of other groups that came together and said, across sector, we all need to come together because it's not only the children and families that are directly impacted by poverty that stand to benefit if we all come together to address it. It's also our communities, our workforce, our economy overall. So we all have a stake in it, and we're really not going to tackle the issue if we're not working together to address it. And importantly, I think fundamental to the way in which we approach our work, we need to be working alongside with and partnering with people who are impacted by poverty, because I think they know better than anyone else what the barriers look like and what the solutions should look like if we're really going to make a difference to lift families out of poverty here in Maine.
And you have some very specific measurable goals.
That's right. So we have gotten we went all around Maine and we talked to lots and lots of people and held forums in Dover Foxcroft, in Aroostook, in Presque Isle, in Lewiston, in Millbridge. And so we heard from a lot of people, and then we got all kinds of input in lots of different ways. And it's clear that we need to be focused on both economic security. So that's making sure that families can meet their basic needs, health care, food, housing. But also economic opportunity, that parents are able to access jobs that allow them to support their families. And so we need to break down some barriers that are standing in the way for too many families, including, a lack of access to affordable childcare, affordable, reliable transportation, which is critical here in Maine in order to get and keep a job in many cases, access to education and training so that people can improve, increase their earning capacity and move out of poverty. So there are some clear issues that we need to tackle and take on. And as part of this initiative, we also are interested in measuring our success and our progress moving forward. So we've created a dashboard, and really like a scorecard to look at how are we doing as a state with respect to these different factors and to make sure that we're moving forward and we're making progress together.
And are the goals and the strategies for reaching those goals, are these basically legislative, we're going to go to Augusta and ask for certain things, or is it different than that?
So I think one thing that came through clearly through all of our conversations out in the community was that we need to address this at all levels. So that includes, at the community level, it includes at the state level, at the federal level, family by family. But also that some of these issues clearly are systemic, and I say systemic in that it's really our systems that we have to make some structural changes that involve making some policy changes, because it's not just a few people who are facing a lack of, transportation here in our state or needing more access to early care and learning. We really need to address these issues systemically and make some policy changes. And there are some real solutions. That's another thing that we've looked at together as a collective, Invest in Tomorrow, is what are the changes we could make that would make the biggest difference, that would really move kind of the trend line in terms of these different indicators that we need to be looking at so that we're making sure that we're really making progress to lift families out of poverty.
And what do you, before we have a caller, a VIP caller in just a minute, but I want to ask both of you, what do you believe are those real solutions?
Well, one of them we believe is access to affordable, high-quality child care. Not enough families have access to that. Some of the administrative policies around getting eligibility, it can be done better so that parents have more quick access to being approved to get a child care subsidy if they qualify from their income, allowing them to quickly get into the workforce rather than having to wait for weeks to get a child care voucher approved.
And then we also know that we can do more to increase opportunity to education and training for adults who want to go back to school and increase their earning capacity through more education. And there are some great things that we've done as a state. The Parents as Scholars Program is a great example that we could build on to do more so that people really have the opportunity to advance their education and training.
Now, that VIP caller I referred to joining us on the line now, Robin Young, who lives in Winterport and knows about poverty firsthand. Robin, thank you so much for calling in. And tell us what your experience was like growing up.
Well, hi there. Yes, I actually I had a lot of different factors that contributed to my situation growing up. I was raised in foster care. And by the age of 15, just before my 15th birthday, I ran away from home into some pretty scary situations. I was, for the majority of time in my teen years, I was homeless. I was involved in sex trafficking, a high degree of violence, other criminal activity. You mentioned ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. This was a big part of my childhood. They assess your experiences on a 1 to 10 scale, and so I'm at a 10. My adverse childhood experiences really impacted me and set me up to fail in a world that wasn't really designed for me. So I grew up in this kind of a situation, and so my transition to adulthood really did not set me up for any type of success. I didn't understand where I could access these pathways to higher education, to better employment, to getting some of these assets that I needed to be able to live a sustainable life. I have three kids, and I left my abusive husband in 2014 and decided that I needed to do something to change my life because I, after being barraged by crisis and not having the ability to take care of myself, I knew that something needed to change. So I took a leap and I went back to school. And this was incredibly challenging for me because, as Robin mentioned, there are some systemic disadvantages for those who are trying to navigate this system to be able to access higher education and other pathways toward this sustainable living. And I was able to graduate from college from the University of Maine with a double degree in social work and sociology in 2017. And just to put another statistic out there, only 3% of foster youth actually have a bachelor's degree. So in essence, I am not supposed to be here.
Robin, how did you do it? Was there any program or approach that helped you?
Yes, if I had to highlight that essential program, I would say the most impactful program that helped me get there was the Competitive Skills Scholarship Program. This is one that's administered by the Department of Labor. It is highly competitive as well. I believe that they only sign on 40 students at a time. And I remember being on the waiting list, and when I got that call saying that I was being pulled from the waiting list to participate, I remember just the tears streaming down my face because I knew that this could be that medium that I needed to get to my goals. And specifically, it was the time that my counselor, Cornell, actually spent with me outlining my goals and helping me get there, so that it was a very client-centered focus. He was able to advocate for me within the program and outside that department. In my senior year, when I needed an extra $600 for school and there was just nowhere to get that, he was able to go up his chain of command and say, listen, what can we do to give this person the approval for the extra $600, and helped me navigate through yet another hurdle that I needed to get through that I didn't have other folks to help me out with those types of things. And just those successful relationships that that program has built with schools and with vendors, and then also with their clients, to be able to get those things that we needed without begging or needing to jump through hoops or prove that we deserved that chance. So I was able to earn work study income while I was in that program. And then so I could concentrate on going to school and manage all of my life crises more effectively as that single mom with kids. And I was able to move out of the motel room I was living right down the street from campus into Section 8 housing and actually be able to start getting myself out of this entrenched poverty, really.
So tell us about your life now. You have your bachelor's degree, three kids. How old are your kids and what are you doing for work?
My oldest child, Sarah, is 17, so she'll be going to college. We're looking at that pathway for her. And then I also have two younger children, age 13 and 7. Right out of college, when I graduated in 2017, I got a job working at Dartmouth College, an Ivy League university, who was looking for a researcher. So I do research in the greater Bangor area, working with a federally qualified health center looking at our opiate crisis here in Maine. And the research field has been something I've always been interested in. I'm currently a graduate student at the University of Maine, where I'm studying the effects of development, the effects of developmental trauma on the life course and how transitioning into adulthood for certain impacted populations can often have some type of success with a developmental approach. And so I'm working a really great job. I'm able to have benefits, vacation days. I have a little more control over these crises that come into my life, and I'm able to navigate these a little bit more. And as a result, my kids have a better chance of going to college and avoiding poverty altogether. My mantra about this cycle is it ends with me. I have been through every ringer and fallen into every crack and cried a thousand tears, and it ends with me.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for sharing your story, and best of luck to you and your children and your daughter in her college search. That's Robin Young. She lives in Winterport. She works as a researcher, as she mentioned, for Dartmouth College. You all are both smiling as you listen to Robin's story. What is the lesson?
I was sitting here thinking that we invested in her as a community, as a society, and we gave her a chance. We didn't give up on her. We saw value in her and in her children. And that's the attitude we need to take with each person experiencing the condition of poverty. Poverty is a condition that our society creates because of the economic situations that we have in our state and our nation. And people who live in poverty, they are living in a condition. I don't like to. It's just the way we describe it is sometimes about the individual, and they are living within a system that we create. And this is a beautiful story of how we did better by one of our people.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Community Foundation, celebrating 35 years of investing in Maine communities. Learn more at mainecf.org. By Fallbrook Woods, a Maine-owned assisted living community in Portland, supporting the unique needs and individual styles of those with memory impairment, fallbrookwoods.com. And People's United Bank, N.A., whose new mobile app helps customers to pay bills and manage accounts from anywhere, peoples.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross talks with Jason Rezaian. He was the only American citizen reporting from Iran on a permanent basis when he was arrested in 2014, accused of being a spy, and held in one of Iran's most notorious prisons. He was released after 2.5 years. Rezaian is suing the Iranian government, and he has a new memoir. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know if you don't have cable, it's still possible to see Maine Public Television, all four channels, The World, Create, and Kids as well? In many areas of Maine, you can watch all four of our television signals with an HD TV antenna. Will that work in your neighborhood? We've created a resource to help you answer that question. Go to mainepublic.org for more information. Click on Television and Guide for Watching Over the Air, or give us a call at 1-800-884-1717, and we'll send the information right away. With or without cable, Maine Public Television brings you four channels of the highest quality programming, an educational resource not to be missed.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what can be done to address childhood poverty in Maine? Joining me on the program today, Robin Merrill, who's Executive Director of Maine Equal Justice, and Claire Berkowitz, Executive Director of the Maine Children's Alliance. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Kara Baldari. She is Vice President of Family Economics, Housing, and Homelessness with the national advocacy group First Focus. Thanks for joining us, Kara.
Thanks so much for having me.
What are you seeing nationally in terms of childhood poverty? Is it falling or rising? And how does Maine compare with other states?
So child poverty remains really high nationally. At First Focus, we like to say that children are one quarter of our population, but all of our future. And yet as a nation, we are continually failing to prioritize their well-being. Across the country, children are 62% more likely to be living in poverty than adults. About 17.5% of all children, which is about 12.8 million children, we're living in poverty in 2017, and to provide some context, that equals a household income of a little under $25,000 a year for a family of four. Maine's rate is lower than the national average and is about the 10th lowest in the country.
What does the research show in terms of how poverty affects a child's development and prospects for the future?
Well, unfortunately, children can suffer long-term negative consequences from experiencing poverty for even a short time. Brain science tells us that limited access to resources such as nutritious food, safe and stable housing, health care, early childhood education can cause trauma and hamper healthy child development. And we know that parents who are living in a constant state of financial instability and who struggle to provide enough resources for their children are more likely to suffer from stress, anxiety, and depression, making it more difficult to respond to their children's emotional needs. And then beyond the negative consequences of child poverty for individual children are the cost to our entire nation. One recent study has found that child poverty costs our country over $1 trillion a year, which represents just a little over 5% of our GDP. And this is due to higher health care costs, as well as costs associated with increased levels of homelessness and child maltreatment that's associated with child poverty.
Kara, before the break, we heard a really powerful story of a young woman from Maine who was helped out of the cycle of poverty by an innovative scholarship program helping her through college. What kinds of programs do you see working and other kind of programs helping people bring themselves and their children out of poverty?
Yeah, I mean, the good news is that we know what works to reduce child poverty. We know that millions of children each year are lifted out of poverty due to programs that provide income support to families. So that includes the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, or formerly known as food stamps, or things like family tax credits, such as the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Tax Credit. And that's because these programs support parents and kids by providing, you know, support so they could have critical resources in their household. And so it has an immediate effect, right, of reducing child poverty through boosting family income, as well as long-term positive effects for children's health and educational achievement and future earnings. But the problem is that our rate remains so high because not enough families have access to this assistance, or the assistance is not enough to lift them over the poverty line. You know, we have Social Security for seniors, right, which is why elder poverty remains so much lower than child poverty, but we have no similar program on that scale for children. So we know we need a greater investment in our children. My organization, First Focus, releases every year an analysis of federal spending on children. And so while children are only a quarter of the population, our analysis finds that we only spend about 8% of our federal budget each year on them, and that number continues to decline.
Kara, thanks so much for calling in. Kara Baldari with the National Advocacy Organization First Focus. We're going to go to Robert, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you, obviously, for the program. I thought it was excellent to hear Ms. Merrill's response in terms of how the community invested in Robin, your guest on the phone. That's kind of where I'm coming from, is the investment that has been tossed around by pretty much everyone so far. I'm a local school teacher. I'm actually home on a sick day, but I otherwise don't get to really call into your program. But passion I have for teaching is about, you know, making that difference. And I think that's where a lot of people come from in the field. My hope is to see from pre-K on through adult ed, the right allocation of resources so that children from a very young age can get the nutrition and education and stable housing that they need, and then go on to break the cycle so that they are able to be more prepared to be productive community members and raise families that are in a safer place than what we're seeing now.
Robert, thanks for calling in. Let me ask you this, though. So many people link education to bringing people out of poverty. Do you ever feel as a teacher like so much is put on the schools?
I absolutely agree. I mean, by default, you know, we have cut appropriate levels of funding, you know, as a society towards the care of our youngest and most vulnerable citizens. And so, yes, the schools become, in particular, the public school systems become the place where they receive additional attention, healthy meals, clinical services, dental services, mental health services. All of these positions are underfunded, understaffed, as far as I'm concerned, in my public school experience. And that also, you know, it's a huge community issue, and really just the size of numbers of students per classroom. You know, even there, you know, if we were right sized, the amount of good that could be transferred to those younger generations would help break the cycle.
Robert, thanks for calling in. We're going to go now to Alina Diaz. Alina is from Warren. She and her family have experienced what it's like living in poverty. Alina, thank you for calling in. Can you share some of your story with us?
Hi. Thanks for having me. So my story is pretty typical. I grew up in Maine, and my family had not previously gone past high school and education. So we were in poverty growing up, didn't have a lot, and I think it just wasn't something that was super important to me after high school because it just wasn't something that I was around. So after high school, I went to work as a waitress, and that was better than a minimum wage paying job. So that kind of sustained me for a while until I had kids. And around that time, I also experienced addiction, which kind of sometimes can go hand in hand with poverty. I didn't have a lot of hope. So around 2014, I had my three girls, and I realized I had to make a change, and I had to lift myself out of the situation I was in. And the way that I thought to do that was to get an education. So I got involved with UMA, and for me, I go to the Rockland Center that's closest to my house, and that really changed everything for me. I still had a lot of barriers to be able to participate, but the school is really supportive. I am a participant in Parents of Scholars, and the idea of Parents of Scholars is wonderful, but there's many times it's not implemented very well. Oftentimes, a big barrier is I'm waiting for help from them. It's very hard to get expenses covered. It's necessary for me to be able to go to school to be a part of Parents of Scholars. They help with transportation, childcare, and things like that. But there's so many issues within that system. I find myself a lot of the time I can't focus on my schoolwork because I'm so worried about the financial end of things. And many times our basic needs are still not met. So I'm hoping that things will start to change in our new administration, and that we'll get a little bit more support, and the attitude towards recipients of Parents of Scholars and TANF will change, because the investment in me has changed so much, and I see the effect it has on my daughters, and that they have more confidence in themselves. They often want to tag along with me to school, and they're seeing that on an everyday basis, that education is important, and loving yourself is important, and valuing yourself and having a purpose. So I see the change in them, and that is my goal, is to be able to stop that cycle and to let my kids be able to experience life in a different way than I had to.
Alina, let me ask you this. What are you hoping college will do for you? Where do you see yourself in 5 or 10 years?
In 5 or 10 years, I hope to see myself graduated. I really enjoy going to school, so I'm not, you know, I can see myself maybe even going to graduate school. The farther I got into school and the more confidence I gained, I was able to see more clearly what I wanted. I started off in mental health and human services, and I changed my degree program to justice studies. As I've experienced so many things in the state and the way that things, I guess, for me, don't run correctly or effectively, my goal is to be able to make a difference in that area. So I changed to justice studies, and I haven't quite found my specific nook that I want to get into, but I hope to be making a difference for people like me and to be sharing my story and to help other women like me to pull themselves out, because it's so possible, but I know many people just don't think they can do it, and it takes a lot of support. So I want to be able to give support to people like that and be able to be have mine and my kids' basic needs met, for me to be able to, pay for things for them, like going on a school trip and being able for them to be able to learn and travel and just do more than survive. I don't want them to have to just survive. So that I hope will be there in a few, a few years.
Alina, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story, and best of luck to you up at UMA. Thank you. Robin, when you hear Alina's story, and I know you've been talking a lot about Parents as Scholars as one of the programs that works, but she says it's not always implemented correctly. You are nodding. You know that.
Yes. And I'm grateful to Alina and to Robin for calling in and sharing their stories, and recognizing that they are both incredibly impressive humans, but also they're not alone. There are a lot of people like them. And there are, in fact, Invest in Tomorrow has identified some priorities for 2019, and one of them is looking at putting reforms in place at DHHS, at the Department of Health and Human Services, so that the state is doing a better job administering programs and supports that are available so that people are able to access them, but also so that the state is starting to really measure data and look at, are we making progress as a state? Are these programs effectively lifting families out of poverty? Are people actually able to access Parents as Scholars? Enrollment in the program has gone down significantly over the last 8 years. A lot of people have actually been discouraged from signing up, even though it is such an opportunity for folks. And we could do a better job at administering it. So we need to put some reforms in place, and we have an opportunity right now to do that. So, I'm grateful to Alina for raising that, because it's an important point.
We'll go to Mandy, who's calling from Holton. Hi, Mandy. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm an accountant, and I work for a lot of small businesses who are struggling. And I think one thing, when you're talking about child poverty especially, you kind of have to go to the root of the problem, and there's a lot of roots to that. And one of those is that small businesses can't afford to pay people more. Yes, minimum wage went up $1, which is great. That helps a little bit, but now we're already starting to see
the cost of things rise. And the state of Maine makes it extremely hard for small businesses to even stay alive. And I think that that's something that really needs to be looked into as well. I mean, if it was easier for them, they didn't have to pay so much to stay in business, they could potentially offer more to their employees. You know, I see people all the time hiring for a specific thing. They require a college degree, but they're only paying maybe $12 an hour. And, you know, it should be a lot more than that. And it's because it's so hard for them to stay in business.
And when you say it's hard for small businesses to stay in business in Maine, you say, and you're saying that's because of the tax burden on the small businesses.
Exactly, the taxes, and it's just the amount of money that they have to pay to be in business is ridiculous.
Mandy, thanks for your call.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what she's saying, and I appreciate that. So, I think we have an opportunity in Augusta to work on some of these issues. It's not a part of the Invest in Tomorrow per se, but it's something we all need to be thinking about going forward. And I just wanted to piggyback on to what Robin was saying about parents of scholars and some of the implementation things. One of the things that happened since 2012 was there was the 60-month time limit was adhered to for the temporary assistance for needy families. That's the program that helps families in poverty. And also stricter sanctions were put in place on families since 2012. And so we've seen a lot, a huge decline in the number of children served by TANF. So, back in 2011, I think we served 24,000 children on TANF. And as of December 2018, there were 7,000 children. And so we're not meeting the basic needs of these kids with income supports that would benefit them, especially those youngest ones who are, as I said earlier, the brain development phase of life, birth to five. So, there are some things that we could change administratively, I think, in terms of serving children again, following up on what Cara said about Social Security being for older people. TANF is for children. And so we need to make sure that we're meeting the needs of children.
We're going to take another quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Milk House, a Maine dairy farm producing organic whole milk yogurt. A complete list of where to find Milk House yogurt is available at mainemilkhouse.com. By Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Folia, in Portland's Old Port, where you'll find jewelry by Maine designers, as well as custom design and repair services. FoliaJewelry.com.
Coal miners often say the work's about more than a job.
I love coal mining. If I was able today, I'd be working in the mines.
But black lung drastically changes their lives.
The day you pick that dinner bucket up and go in the mines, that's the day you sign your death warrant.
I'm Audie Cornish. Coal miners grapple with black lung and their futures this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand talks about gun control, her advocacy on behalf of sexual assault survivors, and her children's book profiling 10 American women who fought for the right to vote. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Coming up shortly at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Childhood Poverty in Maine. My guests, Claire Berkowitz with the Maine Children's Alliance and Robin Merrill with Maine Equal Justice. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Diane. Could your guests discuss ways in which individuals can help lessen the problem? Big sister, weekly food delivery, bring a meal every so often?
Well, those are all wonderful ideas. You know, I think Donna Beagle is a national policy poverty expert, and she came to Maine, and I saw her speak at a training. She talked about the lack of a social network. People who are growing up in poverty don't have the same access to, you know, people through the PTA or through just social networks. So being that person to someone who might be like one of our callers earlier, maybe reaching out to a one of the universities and finding out if there's a young woman who's working her way through school with kids and what do they need. So just something off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think that's great. There are so many things that we can do, you know, in terms of just connecting with our friends and neighbors and people in our community. Yeah. And also individuals can get involved in terms of making policy change happen. Investintomorrow.me is the website. And there are lots of ways that individuals can get involved and really be a part of making change happen on a broader scale, too.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to Anne, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. So I would like to build on two things. One is the idea that being thrust into poverty is a systemic problem, not necessarily an individual problem, and so that the solution, as good as charity is, that we need good government policies. And I would like to build on what Robin said in switching her major from health and human services to justice. Because there is this idea on the left of justice as fairness, as opposed to, you know, the idea of kicking people off, denying people assistance as a way of providing opportunity. So the question that I would like to ask is, since the most impoverished people and their children are the most impacted by what I consider to be bad government policies, how do we get more low-income people and impoverished people to get involved and vote and advocate for politicians who will best serve their own, not necessarily their favorite ideology, but their actually most significant needs?
I mean, I think that is so important. What is so important, thank you for raising this, is that we is engaging. And I think I said at the beginning of this conversation that we couldn't do our work at Maine Equal Justice if we weren't partnering and collaborating and working really closely with people who are impacted by the policies we're working to change. So people who are living poverty and know better than anybody else what the solution should look like. And so we really need to be working together. And that's what we work to do, is to bring folks in to share their stories. Because as policymakers are making decisions, they really should be informed by the real lived experience of people. You know, and hearing from Alina, hearing from Robin, and knowing, you know, more about their story and what it takes to really lift yourself out of poverty, I think is critical. And that's the only way we can really make good change happen.
Robin, you just used the word lift. That's part of the policy plan, isn't it?
Yeah. So the last couple years, the legislature has passed legislation that's taken on the acronym LIFT, Leveraging Investments in Families for Today, for Tomorrow. This year, there's a LIFT bill again, Leveraging Investments so Families Can Thrive. And it's the focus of this legislation. So there have been some efforts that have been successful, and some changes have been put in place the last couple years that will increase economic security and opportunity for families. But there's so much more we can do. And so that's what LIFT 3.0 is about. That's what Invest in Tomorrow is about, is how can we build on kind of the success we've had so far? There are real solutions we can put in place. I think sometimes poverty feels like there's nothing we can do about it. It's an intractable problem and we can't address it. Well, there actually are some real solutions we can put in place, and there are lots of ways to do that. And so we hope that folks will get engaged and involved to make change happen.
Anne, thanks for calling in. We'll move up to Albion and Lisa. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to call. My brother and sister and I grew up in deep poverty in Washington County. We know firsthand about government housing, food stamps, and the dreaded government cheese. Although it was tough, you know, it certainly wasn't a picnic. All of us left Washington County and have gone on to be very successful. My sister's a PhD candidate. My brother is a manager at an international corporation, and I have a small horse training business. And we all learned really young, my brother especially, who started work at age 9, that if there's something you want, you need to work for it. And you need to buckle down and just go for it. And my first job was 14, and then I worked two jobs through college. When I was home for the summer, I worked at college. And we just learned life lessons that perhaps we wouldn't have otherwise.
So, Lisa, what do you think was the difference for your family? Why are all three children in your family able to sort of beat the odds and do so well?
I think in part Washington County is, I don't think I'm saying anything negative, but it's kind of a hard scrabble place. You either sink or swim. And we were very cognizant of that as children, that, you know, you need to get moving and get going. At one point we were all buying like our own, you know, clothing at very young ages. And I think having the opportunity to work, we had a faith-based education. We had the support of our local church. We just were able to focus and say, we see how life is here. We don't want to do this ourselves. So we need to get moving, go forward.
So it sounds as though you did have social support for your siblings and yourself. That support was your church and your family.
More the church than the family, and just our own gumption and grit, which, you know, my brother now is a manager, often remarks that, you know, he says it wasn't a lot of fun the way we grew up, he says, but we have determination and a hard work ethic that he does not see in a lot of the employees that are at his particular facility.
Lisa, thank you so much for your call and sharing your story.
Yeah, I think it raises a point for me. We hear from people all the time as we help folks to kind of navigate the system and try to meet their basic needs. And so many of the people we talk with work really hard. And I think there's this kind of – there's a myth out there that mm-hmm. people living in poverty aren't working hard or aren't trying hard enough. And in fact, the folks we talk with every day are working incredibly hard, and it's still difficult to make ends meet and to get by. And that's why we're really looking at, you know, what are the ways in which we can create pathways so that folks who are working hard are able to get ahead and able to make improve their circumstances.
Yeah. Lisa, go ahead. I was thinking the exact same thing, Robin, and also hearing her say that she, you know, they had some housing support. You know, it was a combination of things that allowed them to be successful, and it's the way we invest in people at the community level, and that's a wonderful story of that.
Thank you, Lisa. An email from Dan. Why, if we have sex education in the schools for 40 years, why are we still having children we can't afford to feed? Well, that's the problem.
I will speak to the fact that we've brought down the teen pregnancy rate in Maine and the nation, historic lows. So one of the areas where we're seeing young parents who are out of high school, 18 to 24 year olds, there's an issue, not an issue, but there's low income parents are more likely to be in that age group. So we have work to do. Those are mostly people who maybe aren't going to college, might have a job, but aren't connected to those social support services that you get in a high school like sex ed, and access to a school-based health center. Or if you're at college, you have access to those things as well. So if you're not connected to those social support networks in that age group, so how can we maybe work with employers to play that role in that age group? That might be an interesting solution.
We'll go to Debbie calling from Augusta. Hi, Debbie. Go ahead.
Hi there. I started in Maine, and I'm back here in Maine. But when I was in Massachusetts, 30 years ago, I was a volunteer member of the Office for Children. I don't know whether you've ever heard of it or not, but we volunteered to be grandparent mentors of the kids. And the children are not afraid of the grandparents as much as they are of a parental authority. So that worked very, very well. And one of the things I discovered was that the kids in the city have an 8-block radius for getting out and seeing people and seeing variety. We have an 8-mile radius. Children can't have dreams unless they have the vocabulary for that or the visiting vocabulary. So that was one of the things we learned. Survival skills to me are terribly important. I think that kids should be taught foraging and collecting because we've got so much food in the state. It's unbelievable. It is wild. And cooking and collecting can follow that. The granny curriculum is very important to me.
Well, thank you, Debbie, for your call. Are there programs in Maine in which people who are grandparent age can volunteer to be part of the lives of children?
I don't know of anything specifically, but I'm sure that there are through Big Brothers, Big Sisters, those types of programs. I'm sure you could reach out to your local chapters and find out ways you can be a part of a child's life.
Thank you, Debbie. We'll move on to Elizabeth, who's calling from Mechanic Falls. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. Every year I do Toys for Tots. It started because my sister is a low-income single parent, and they needed more help that they weren't getting. And in that time, I started with 27 kids the first year, and this last year had over 300 across three different counties and four different nonprofit organizations. And what I've noticed lately is that I have more and more people not just asking for, you know, a few extra toys to help out, but asking me to help them accomplish things like basic health care, getting their kids checkups, getting their kids flu shots, helping them find food banks and access to basic needs because they're not getting them, even if they are enrolled in programs like TANF. They're not getting enough funds, or they're not being told what programs they are eligible for through that. Like, there's dental programs and stuff like that through TANF that no one tells these people that they have access to.
Elizabeth, thanks for your call. Is that something you all hear as well?
Definitely. There's a lack of awareness about what resources are available. And just want to thank, incredibly, that's a great, I love 27 to 300 kids, and that's huge and makes a big difference for those families. But recognizing that we need bigger solutions because, you know, there's no reason living in the country we live in that's as wealthy as, you know, the United States is, that people should be going hungry, should be forced to live on the streets. But that's where we're at. And so there are these larger solutions we need. It's getting the information out to people so they know about what resources are available, but then really making some structural changes,
right,
so that we don't have the number of families we see now who are going without just basics.
That's right. Yesterday was Martin Luther King Day. And, you know, at the end of his life, what he was talking most about was poverty and anti-poverty programs. Charity wasn't going to solve it. Justice was. And so we still are facing and grappling with that today. It's systemic issues, systemic racism, institutionalized structures that we've created in our country that have kept people in poverty for a lot of different reasons. We see it here in Maine. We see wide disparities across our children of color, and so there's bigger issues than, you know, Toys for Tots is wonderful, but it's not going to get at the root cause, which is family income and access to good jobs and education.
Well, Elizabeth, thanks so much for your call, and thank you both for being here in the studio with me today. The voice you just heard, Claire Berkowitz, Executive Director of the Maine Children's Alliance, and Robin Merrill, Executive Director of Maine Equal Justice. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can hear this show broadcast again tonight at 8. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.